You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This is the CRM Archaeology Podcast. It's the show where we pull back the veil of cultural resources management, archaeology, and discuss the issues that everyone is concerned about. Welcome to the podcast. Hello and welcome to the CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 148 for October 24th, 2018. I'm your host, Chris Webster. On today's show, we have another Random Encounters episode, the Lovecraft edition. So put your nerd hat on and grab your trowel because the CRM Archaeology Podcast starts right now. Welcome to the show, everyone. Joining me from Reno today is Sonia in Utah.
Hey, how are ya?
And East Coast Bill in Maryland, although if Bill White doesn't show up, he'll just be Bill for today. So Bill in Maryland.
Hi there.
And Stephen in Calgary.
Good morning.
And Ruckus has already been making some noise, so we'll just introduce Ruckus. And Ruckus in Calgary as well, just in case he decides to join us.
Kind of wandered off.
Nice. He'll be back, I'm sure, when he gets some FOMO. So
when it's my turn to talk, yeah.
Yeah, well, it's your turn to talk, of course. All right, so this is my first Random Encounters episode. We'll link to the other two that you guys have done, Bill and Steven. So, you know, a few times this past few months, whatever, I've had times where I couldn't make the show, and Steven and Bill stepped in, and a couple times they did this Random Encounters episode. So I'm excited to be able to participate in this rather than just edit and listen. And it's a slightly different version of this as well. So I'm going to throw it over to Bill in Maryland, West Coast Bill, East Coast Bill. We're going to have to fix this. We got to come up with some kind of nickname. I don't know what to tell you, but East Coast Bill to describe what we're going to do today. So go ahead.
Okay. So this time, because we're in October, we're getting close to Halloween. I figure we do something a little horror themed, a little spooky since we're that time of year. So we're going to sort of focus on the works of Howard Philip Lovecraft, H.P. Lovecraft, an early 20th century American author, most known for his weird fiction, short stories, and things like that. And was very influential in sort of the horror genre that would grow throughout the 20th century. He's also known for his sort of problematic nature. He runs the sort of trifecta of racism, xenophobia, and misogyny. He sort of got all three covered in throughout his work and his life. In addition, sort of the works of Lovecraft are inspirational to some of the pseudosciences we still are dealing with today, including things like the that show we don't talk about on the History Channel. So with that in mind, we're going to use that as our sort of our launching pad for some discussions. A little darker, a little more horror based, because horror is always a great, any genre in general, is a great platform to sort of talk about difficult issues in a format where it's maybe a little safer to go with that. So I believe Steven's going to roll a die, and then from there, we're going to randomly decide which topic will be our first one.
All right, let's do it. Let's get rolling.
Okay, and I'm using a D8. Is that correct?
Yes, we are using D8 this time.
Your strange geometries, man.
Not Euclidean.
8.
All right, so we're going to 8, which is the short story Rats in the Hall. So to give you sort of a brief background, the story Rats in the Hall was about an American who goes over to England to live in his ancestral estate. While living there, he starts hearing the sounds of rats scurrying in the wall. Through research, he finds out that his family had an underground city and that they were cannibals raising human cattle. It just drives him mad. He becomes a cannibal, but blames it on the rats in the wall. So with that, how that's going to tie to sort of CRM archaeology is the idea of sort of mental health within the field. We can and are often stressed working in this field, and sort of mental health and the challenge of mental health for those who work in the CRM field is sort of the pivot we're going to try to do here.
Mm-hmm. So you're practitioners of CRM and their mental health.
Yes.
Well, let me go first beyond this because, I haven't been part of these episodes. I'm pretty excited right now, but this is the kind of thing I've been focusing on for, my God, almost the entire time I've been in CRM archaeology. I started my blog. I mean, a lot of the things that I was trying to do was to increase the, I guess, the well-being of CRM archaeologists and to try to talk to people about being in the field. Because I think that's one of the biggest things we have a problem with for retention is mental health and well-being. And part of the huge problem for that, I think, is people treating out-of-town field projects like they're on vacation, which is no surprise because we associate, until you get into a field where you travel a lot, you tend to associate hotels and camping and anytime you're not at home, you tend to associate that with time off, with time away, and a different sort of attitude that you take to it. So, you know, you get off work, you go into the hotel room, maybe you just lounge around and watch TV because you've got that vacation sort of attitude. Maybe you, you know, sit out and drink with your friends, you go out, you do whatever. And before you know it, you're 50 and you've been doing that for 25 years and you've accomplished literally nothing. And you're, you just like, you look back on your life and you're like, what the hell have I been doing with my life? I've been partying and drinking the whole time. Now, maybe that's what you set out to do. I don't know. But for a lot of people, I think that they're maybe looking for something more and they don't get into that routine when they get into a, when they get into a hotel, they don't have that routine. They don't bring their own things in and set it up as their own home. And even if they're only there for a week, you know, you don't have to be there for months to do that. You can be there for 3 days, but set up your own stuff and do your own thing. That's where I think the crux of that problem comes from is the attitude towards field work and how that affects you mentally. So those are my two thoughts. Anyone else?
Okay. I had a couple of thoughts about this. I've always felt kind of on occasion, I feel almost like a faker. And I know this is kind of a common thing for archaeologists coming out of school or even after they've developed their professional careers. They've got this great degree. They're very well educated. They're very open-minded. They're very skilled at what they're doing. But yet at the same time, they kind of feel like they're faking it. And it kind of fits into Lovecraft's theme of maybe inherited guilt, as if, like, for example, my family were good, hardworking Germans. There is absolutely nothing about archaeology that is easy, in my opinion. So I've always thought that I've been a very hard worker. But to my family, my work is recreational. It's something that's supposed to be fun. And you go out and you have a good time doing it and you get to go drink with all your friends, just like you were saying, Chris. You know, and you have this, you start having this feeling that maybe you are not working hard, or you recognize, one side of your brain recognizes, yes, I am working very hard to get this work done. And I'm very skilled at what I'm doing. But you start feeling a little bit like a faker because you're not working the 9 to 5 that, you know, all your friends are. You're going out and you're traveling a lot, unlike most of your friends, unless most of your friends are archaeologists, to be fair. You know, but within my own family, I have this level of guilt on occasion that maybe I am not a good, hardworking German girl. woman, you know, right. Even though I work my ass off, you know what I mean? And that's part of mental health. I mean, that's something that we want to talk about with young professionals in this field, how perceptions of your job and what your job actually is can play tricks on you and can play around with your emotional state a little bit. And I don't really have a resolution to that other than acknowledging that something like that can happen and don't let it play tricks on you. You're a professional. You're good at what you're doing. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So there's my perspective on that.
Okay. Well, to kind of tie all that together, I think maybe a little bit, I feel like a good portion of the mental health issues involve kind of security. That it's not something we often have, right? Like, you know, we you know, like work real hard in our 20s and 30s, like with the idea that eventually you're going to make it, right? Like, and you're going to have like a permanent job, and you know, maybe things will get a little bit easier, like because there's a little bit more stability. But that's not really the case. Like, there's that hustle that you have to do never really goes away, and by the time people are getting into their 30s or 40s or 50s or, you know, 30s or beyond, after doing it for about 10 years, you start getting, you know, start realizing that, you know, this is really all it is. It doesn't, you know, yeah, you're going to move up to running projects and stuff like that. But beyond that, it doesn't get easier, right? Like it just keeps going. And I think that definitely like erodes at the sense of well-being. You know, that's the rat noise in the walls, right? But then to kind of go back down to that inherited guilt, like we see other archaeologists doing really big, grandiose projects. It's kind of like that social media thing where, you know, we see a lot of, you know, particularly doctoral students, doctoral candidates working on these really, you know, cool, large projects that are, you know, really great for collaboration and working with, you know, descendant populations and you know, and communities and all this. And it's great. And then we have to turn around and break our backs, you know, digging a bunch of sterile holes. And so there's that weird sort of disconnect between what we do and what we see, particularly academic archaeologists sometimes do, but, you know, very visibly do. And we have kind of that, like, we should be doing something more than what we're doing. And that also kind of degrades our, like mental image of how we're doing, and it, you know, can be a little bit hard.
I got a comment on that real quick, because I think that's one of the big takeaways I took when I was in the Navy. One of my division chiefs, who was really influential on me, told me, he said, "Hey, anywhere you go, anything you do, whether it's here in the Navy or, you know, later on in life," it said, "stay there for a little bit and then look at all the people around you and look at the people that have been doing the job that you're doing right now. Look at the ones that started there and the ones that have been in this for 20, 30 years and say, is that where I want to be in 20 or 30 years? And if it's not, then leave now because you're wasting your time." And I would give the same advice to CRM archaeologists. And I would say, look around you and how many people do you see after your first year of being in the field or your first field season, how many people have a permanent job? And then define the word permanent, because I've known people that have worked for the same place for 7, 8, 9, 10 years, you know, maybe even longer. And then all of a sudden things change and they're out. You know, no pension, no retirement, no nothing. They're just out. Whether the company restructured, they went through a downturn in the economy, something happened, and now they're off working somewhere else. So look at those people that do have what you consider a secure job in this field and say, what's their hook? For a lot of business owners, for a lot of current company owners, they've been company owners since the 80s, and they were in the right place at the right time when there weren't very many companies. So that hook is gone. That's never going to happen again. What's the other hook? You know, do they have something that is special about them? If you're just coming out of college and you don't have that, and you're just digging holes, you're just surveying in the field, you don't have anything special. I hate to break that to you, but you don't have anything special. So what's your hook going to be? What's your thing that you're going to do that's going to be different, that's going to break you out of that herd and get you that secure lifestyle that you want? It's not just going to happen. That's just a fact. It's not going to happen. You have to create it. And whether you, even if you think you have a permanent job somewhere, there's a really good chance you don't. And just look at the people around you and see how long they've been there. And the ones that have been there over 20 years, if there are any, get to be their friends and find out how they did it. Find out what they did and then follow on their coattails if that's what you want to do. So I don't know.
Boy. Yeah. Ain't that the truth?
Right?
Get to be friends with the guys who have been in there really long.
Yeah.
A really long time. Yeah.
Yeah. Bill, do you have anything on this before we roll the dice again?
Well, I think sort of wrap things up on there is that you know, things that I thought about when writing this was the idea of sacrifice. Any career requires sacrifice, and CRM archaeology is no different. It's just that the sacrifices are manifest themselves in different ways. To go back to sort of your Chris's early example about the out of town projects, potential pitfall is the idea of treating it like a vacation. The other pitfall, though, is sort of the time that the project or the company takes from you. During those things, you're not going to be home. You're away from home. You're going to be not necessarily paid for your weekends, even though you're away from home. And the, you know, for some people, the constant travel is a very, you know, is part of the appeal of the process. But for those who, you know, are looking for some sort of stability in a home life, that constant travel can be draining and wearing. There's the sort of constant pull to do things outside of work, whether that's a pull from yourself wanting to be a better archaeologist or a pull from a company or a pull from an organization you're in. You know, you could find yourself doing things like, I don't know, recording podcasts on the weekend when you could be watching football. Or, you know, preparing conference papers for a conference you're paying out of your own pocket because you want to give some information out to the general public or to a public in aspects of it. So there's this constant drumbeat of sacrifice that occurs as a professional archaeologist. And the key with that is to always keep a balance between you leading your passion and not your passion leading you. So I see that as a definite strain in terms of the mental health aspects of it. Because once your passion starts driving you, it no longer becomes fun. It becomes a chore. It becomes a burden, and it becomes a weight on your shoulders. So always make sure that you are the one leading your passion and not the other way around.
Indeed. Okay. Well, with that, you know, since we're so close to a break, let's just take a break and then we'll have a slightly longer second segment. And maybe we'll get through two of these.
Okay.
Maybe not. I don't know. So let's take a break and we'll be back on the other side for segment two of this Lovecraft edition of the CRM Archaeology Podcast.
This network is listener supported. We're trying to move away from paid advertising while also creating new shows and supporting the ones we have. Every little dime we make goes back into the network and improving show quality. So become a member today at www.archpodnet.com/members to show your support, get some extras, and be a benefactor for archaeological education. Members get stickers, a coffee mug, a t-shirt, bonus content, early access to episodes, a private Slack team to talk to other members and the hosts, and full access to training on Team Black over at arccert.black. So check out our memberships at www.archpodnet.com/members today and support archaeological education. That's www.archpodnet.com/members. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to segment two of episode 148 of the CRM Archaeology Podcast. And it's our Lovecraft Edition Random Encounters episode. And I got a note real quick that Sonia had to take off. She would only be able to record one segment with us because she had some pre-existing appointments. So it's just myself and East Coast Bill and Steven. So let's roll the dice.
All right, let's get into it.
Here we go. Does the microphone pick that up?
Yes, it does.
Cool. It is A2.
It is A2. So that is going to bring us to non-Leucidian geometry. I always pronounce that wrong.
Yeah.
So I did a little research this morning. Non-Leucidian geometry is the best way to sort of explain it, where Leucidian geometry, you have two dimensional space, pair of lines, they never touch. In the non-Leucidian space, they can either be hyperbolic, curving away from each other, or epileptic, curving towards each other. In the Lovecraft world, what that means is you're seeing a landscape that shouldn't be. Your visual landscape is off. The world does not look the way it is supposed to. So with that in mind, I thought within the world of CRM archaeology, that sounds a lot like geospatial technologies. Our use of all the different geospatial tools we use to sort of interpret the world, which may not actually look the same way that our physical eyes perceive it. And then maybe any problematic natures that come from sort of looking at a world in a way that's different than how we perceive it.
Yeah, thinking about that, where what we think we see, when we're out in the field and we're like recording positive shovel tests or surface finds or whatever, and then we're doing sketch maps and stuff like that. And then we get back to the lab and we start processing the GPS data. And it's like, wow, those are way farther apart than I imagined. Like the way that we perceive the landscape doesn't inherently translate to how it looks on a two-dimensional map. And it'll be interesting to see how in future in the future, when we start incorporating more of a like an immersive technological aspects, you know, augmented reality and stuff like that, if we're actually better able to replicate, you know, what we think we see out in the field, and is it a matter of that, like the GIS and GPS technologies that we're using right now are, you know, fail to capture what's actually there, or is it the other way around that, you know, what we think we're seeing when we're out in the field doesn't actually, you know, isn't actually just borne out in the data, right? Like it just, you know, we're imagining the way that we think the landscape is structured.
I mean, I was thinking of that in terms of like when you're out in the field and you're doing, say, like a simple phase one survey, you're setting up your grid, you're setting up your transects, and the traditional method is you're pulling tapes and you're using compasses to sort of create your lines, create your transects. And then you shoot all those things into your GPS and sort of the exact example you're talking about. In the field, everything looks like perfectly straight grid lines. Everything's cool. You upload it and you are wonky and you're moving and so forth. And some of it has to do with the limitations of the technology. There's a buffer, sort of an area for the accuracy, depending on what kind of unit you're using. But I think some of it also has to do with some of the illusions created on a landscape, because most of us don't operate on a perfectly flat plane. There are going to be hills and other sort of terrain features which take away from what we see versus what a machine can perceive it from a top-down perspective.
Right. Well, and you know, we could even take it further and to, you know, add more of a horror aspect, just the horrors of like the data not being what you think it's going to be when it comes out. And Sony was just talking to that before we started recording, you know, like what's that point? That point's not labeled. Or, you know, where your data, it's like you have three points with the same name or stuff like that. That's a horrible sinking feeling, or maybe something never got recorded.
Yeah, and we're sort of dependent upon the technology now. Like we're no longer sort of, you know, seeing our papers and our measurements to sort of lock us in place. We're relying on these tools, these machines, which we, for the most part, don't have a true understanding of to sort of guide us in these things. It's, you know, it seems true of computers and sort of all technology. We trust them, but we don't understand them. And so when things fail, that creates sort of an uneasiness, a very Lovecraftian feel, as it were, of otherness and cosmic horror and all that kind of good stuff when you're looking at things like that.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, Bill, about how when things fail, you know, we don't understand, you know, how to deal with that. And I'm reminded of the article I just read about the Soyuz capsule that took off on its way to the International Space Station and had to abort the takeoff for it. I think they're still under investigation. I'm not sure they know what happened just yet. But either way, you know, they ended up with like a 15-minute flight from takeoff to basically crash landing in Kazakhstan versus 6 months on the International Space Station. And the U.S. astronaut who I was reading the article about, he was saying, you know, we trained for this. Almost this exact scenario was one of our training scenarios for the last like 3 years. You know, he's just been going over and over and over and over. And when that started happening, when the shit hit the fan and they were in this ballistic trajectory mode where they were headed to the ground, they knew what to do. They knew what to expect. You know, it was a little bit different because it was real life, but, you know, they knew what to expect. And I don't feel like the training on equipment that we get in CRM is like that. You know, we get this surface level training on equipment, especially what we see as complicated. I mean, anything, let's be honest, more complicated than a pencil or a trowel is frightening to most archaeologists. And, you know, it's this, let's be honest, I'm a techie kind of guy. And when I first got into CRM, I'm looking at a Trimble, I'm looking at a total station going, wow, I really want to learn how to use one of those. But most people on the cruise are like, you know, it's very few people that can use these devices because, you know, they're the ones that have learned to do it. And then you learn that the people that are using those devices, like if even one tiny little thing goes wrong, they just don't get it. You know, they don't understand it. My first real encounter with that was on this phase three I did up in the Northwest, the Pacific Northwest. And we had a Trimble out there, and the project, one of the project managers that was out there, a total station. We had a total station. And one of the project managers was like, first off, 2-3 weeks into the excavation that we're doing, I'm like, hey, are we going to do any sort of recording on these units that we're digging, like spatially? And she said, yeah, there's a total station in the barn there that we were using to store all our stuff on this, this person's property. I was like, oh, and she's like, yeah, I haven't used that brand before, so I'm not really sure how to set it up. And I was like, oh shit, can I take a look at it? Cause I don't know either, but I want to learn. And I ended up taking it home for a weekend because we were Monday through Friday and spent a lot of hours on YouTube because the manual was indecipherable and really figuring out what to do. And it turns out, and then I became, just because I had this surface level knowledge of the device, I became like the expert. And for the next month and a half, did all the spatial stuff for that site using the Total Station. But that's not the way things should be. We should have some deeper knowledge of these things and some better training, I think, so we can understand not only how to fix it when it goes wrong, but really how to use these devices. Because, you know, we've got $5,000, $10,000, $15,000 GPSs out there, and we only know how to do like 2% of what they're capable of. So,
yeah, no, that's exactly right.
Yeah. All right, let's try to get one more in on this segment.
All right, Stephen, let's roll the dice.
Here we go. Seven.
Seven. Lucky seven. That is going to be the thing on the doorstep. So that's another one of these Lovecraftian short stories. It involves a man who has killed his best friend, and he's trying to explain why he killed him and why that wasn't really murder. It turns out that his best friend was being possessed by his wife, who in reality was being possessed by her father through some sort of dark occult-like magic. With that. So you have three different identities running through this person at once. And so with that, I was just thinking about that, thinking about the idea of identity in CRM. So when we're doing, you know, excavations and we're doing work out in the field, and especially if we're dealing with peoples without a documented history, of applying things like identity to those people with that, and some of these sort of traps that come into play when playing around in that world of identity, of sort of like project, maybe, and this story is about projection, the idea of projecting sort of our own interpretive identities onto a people rather than letting that the evidence and those people themselves get into that.
Okay, I'll start on this one. I've got some opinions on this, but first I want to welcome West Coast Bill to the show. He just joined in. How's it going, Bill?
Good.
Okay. So I just want to let everybody know you were here. So my thoughts on this, you know, when I look at CRM archaeology in particular, and just really to narrow this down to archaeology, okay, let's not look at anything else from the anthropological perspective, the four field approach, all that stuff, just archaeology. And when I narrow that down to the science of doing archaeology, it's really more of a technical thing, right? I see us in the field, especially in CRM, as really the data collectors for whatever we're doing out there. We're collecting all the hard science data, whether it's the, like we talked about earlier, the geospatial data, or the, you know, the data about the artifacts and the features and the landscape and all that stuff. We're writing down what we see. We're writing down what, you know, what our experience is out there. And we're doing that all from a data collection perspective. And it gets real sticky when we start applying meaning to all that, right? It gets real sticky when we start saying, you know, oh, I found this, this, and this, dot, 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 this happened, right? I don't even necessarily want to go that route in CRM archaeology. I want somebody to do that. I want somebody to later on say, what does all this mean? You know, all this data you collected, what does all this mean? You know, maybe that's a small section in the report, but I don't even think it belongs there, quite frankly. I think it belongs in a longer thing that somebody would, you know, maybe a student or some other researcher comes in, collects all this information and then makes these determinations and using, you know, Native American cultural input for the area and gathering all this stuff up. When we try to make those assumptions and we try to make those, I guess, determinations of identity and what does it all mean in a CRM report where we have 6 hours, you know, set aside in the budget to do that. It's just like, it's surface level. It doesn't matter. It doesn't mean anything. You know, it's just, I don't feel like we can do it justice. So I like to focus on the data collection and make sure that is spot on and 100% and the best that we can possibly do. So later on down the road, somebody can make those determinations about identity and things like that. What do you guys think?
Well, there never seems to be a later on down the road. This is it. This is always the time.
Well, not for us. Not for us, but that stuff is sitting in a BLM or state agency, you know, file cabinet somewhere. And, you know, we can be optimistic that maybe sometime down the road, somebody will have the time to go look through these things and make those determinations.
Yeah. I mean, especially in historic archaeology, historic sites, there's almost a pressure to go forward and to get this information. When you have certain clients and agencies, where just presenting the technical data doesn't work when there's a library, a history to an area. You're supposed to do the analysis of incorporating your findings into that existing history. You are engaging in that game of identity, and you are running into the pitfalls. Ideally, yes, especially CRM work, where we don't get to pick all the time the sites, the boundaries of our research, the best we can normally tell out of most everything we do is just the information based upon the data recovery, and allow for a future, which may or may not ever occur, to actually incorporate that. I'm thinking of our past episode on synthesis, where we collect the data and then maybe let a synthesis analysis sort of take broader meanings out of there. But I especially know here in the East Coast of the U.S., where there's more of a historical documentation, more of historic archaeology, there's a pressure to come up with those interpretations because of the context you're working in.
Yeah, not only that, but the historic preservation narratives and the justification for saying something is a historical property we have to do that. I mean, we have to do that in order to fill out the National Register form, right? So it's super easy to say, nah, it doesn't fit any of the four criteria. So, you know, it doesn't have any integrity, it doesn't have workmanship, it doesn't have any of that stuff, and it doesn't contribute to A, B, C, and D. Therefore, you know, it's not a historic site. But if you do say it's a historic site, you have to justify it. And, you know, doing that is going to have to do some kind of interpretation and adding that extra level of analysis that is exactly what you said we shouldn't be adding. The kind of thing that makes it interesting. What makes this 1750s house different than the 45 other 1750s houses in Connecticut? Like, what's the story? What's the connection, right? Yeah. Why is this particular archaeological site and these petroglyphs particularly interesting? You know, why?
I think we can collect enough data in the field to make at least those determinations, you know, especially your NRHP determinations, because you're right. We should be doing that. We're the front line. We're the ones that were out there and we saw it. And in the case of CRM in the West Coast, maybe the site was destroyed after we saw it. You know, who knows? Unless our recommendation suggested otherwise. But, you know, I'm proposing a little more of a radical shift. And let's just take the BLM as an example here in Nevada, because, you know, most of Nevada is BLM land. So a lot of it, you know, we have to deal with that. But let's just take that as an example. So if we removed the section of the report in the billing where it says, hey, come up with, you know, what does it all mean section, and then periodically the BLM used those funds to pool them all together and to hire somebody in a separate project to say, hey, let's do a synthesis of the last year's reports on this valley, this area, and see what we can come up with, you know, rather than each company doing it on their own for a 200 acre survey or even a 2000 acre survey. What can we really even say about that small of an area to begin with? And Stephen, I think you had your hand up first.
Yeah. Well, the problem with that is that in order to do like a synthesis that easily based off of a, you know, bringing in all the reports and stuff like that, has to be built upon basically a common framework. And I think to bring it back to that thing on the doorstep, we have established frameworks that we categorize data in. Without getting too interpretive about what our particular sites are, we still go through a system of categorization. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We're just assigned things to categories and types, and it's like, well, this is, you know, such and such phase, this is such and such focus, you know, whatever. But that's when East Coast Bill was talking, you know, reading off the description, that's kind of what was going through my head for this segment, is that we tend to, you know, shove things into a pre-existing identity that we've established probably 30 to 40, 50 years ago, without regard for, you know, like, are those still valid? That you know, how those identities and categories and types, you know, are reflect actual, you know, the previous land use and stuff like that. That, you know, that's where the fall down is that, you know, we're projecting, you know, our scientific identities onto things that, you know, aren't necessarily meant to work with.
Well, I got another suggestion that's kind of radical. Why don't we just hire the people from those cultures to be archaeologists with us? I mean, that in certain places wherever I've been, that's a lot of times been the kicker. I remember a couple of projects I ended up being part of while I worked at Arizona that were kind of doing exactly that. A CRM company had gone by and they had only focused on the data and they had only recorded what teepee rings they could see. And then there was this entire universe of stuff that you couldn't really see unless you had the traditional cultural knowledge or you were from the Blackfeet tribe. And so as a result, when they did finally knuckle down and hire some native monitors, the monitors were asking, why are you driving drill rigs through these, you know, archaeological sites? And they were saying, well, it's not on the map. The archaeologist already found all the sites. And they're saying, well, look right here. Here's the rings and there's the rock formation and there it all is. And so when that all came, you know, to the awareness of the tribe, the government agency ended up having to send out a whole nother contract to have to do exactly what you were saying, to have them go out there and interpret these things with the knowledge of actually being native in that area and preventing another DAPL from happening. So they had, you know, consultants that were well aware. If they had hired those same young people who identified that stuff, you know, it would have been too bad. The elders would not have come out, but also they wouldn't have had to sacrifice their whole cultural knowledge because the young people would have shown them where all these extra sites were at and they would have been on the map and then they could have avoided them, right? And it happens with all kinds of communities too when you are just making these decisions for folks and then even thinking that you're the good guy by going and asking them, you know, hey, can you guys tell me all your cultural secrets so I can put it in my report real fast? How about just hiring those people to be the CRM people to help you so that you don't end up, you know, screwing this up? The Secretary of Interior Standards doesn't say in, you know, every single project that every person out there has to be meet the Secretary of Interior Standards. An SOI archaeologist has to supervise the effort, but there's nothing that prevents you from hiring other individuals with cultural knowledge who are able-bodied to go out there and help prevent you from screwing up.
Yeah. And even if, to take that a step farther, even if, let's say you're on a project where everybody, quote, site recording does have to meet Secretary of Interior standards, you could still have a cultural advisor on board. They're not necessarily doing the recording, but they're advising you in the field on what's going on. I don't think that would be, I don't think that would be something that you'd have to explain on any project. That would be totally legit. It's is the money there for it? That's the big question. And we need to make it there. It just needs to be part of it.
So. I was going to say the money doesn't seem to be there for, you know, techs and other people who don't know what they're doing to screw sites up.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. All right. So we are going to take our final break of the episode and we'll come back and see if we can't get through a couple more of these on the other side of the break.
Hey, podcast fans and digital archaeologists. Have you heard about WildNote? It's a data collection app that works online or offline on your smartphone or tablet, iOS or Android. It allows you to collect field data easily, manage data efficiently, and generate data reports and site records effortlessly. We have a growing list of state site forms built in for your use and some generic forms that will work anywhere. Check out the shovel testing and photograph forms. You can get a free all-access 30-day trial today by going to wildnoteapp.com. That's wildnoteapp.com for your free 30-day trial. Are you tired of the webinars and training offered by the big organizations not being free for members and not really covering what we need? Team Black has the answers. Check out arccert.black/main for our upcoming webinar schedule. All of our webinars happen once a month and seating is limited. Learn everything from field tech basics to drones to digital workflows. We have more classes coming online every month. Classes are always 1 hour and cost just $20. Classes like building a CV and getting a job are always free. That's right. We'll help you get a job, then we'll be here when you want to level up your skills. If you are a professional subscriber to the APN at arcpodnet.com/members, then you get all of Team Black's offerings for free as part of your membership. We have Team Black memberships coming that will give the same for the APN. So $20 a month gets you all the APN swag and extras, plus free training from Team Black. So check out arccert.black for more information and level up your skill set today. That's arccert.black. Now back to the show. Welcome back to the final segment of the Sierra Mark Podcast, episode 148, our Random Encounters Lovecraft Edition episode. Steven, let's roll the dice.
Let's do this. One.
One. One will bring us to Eldritch Horror. So Eldritch Horrors are... I have my notes here. Let me see. Are uncanny, unearthly, and weird in a supernatural way. So this one is sort of the... Your horror stories from the field. It's time to share some ghost stories from the field.
Okay. I'm sure we've all got some of those. Who wants to go first?
I can lead it off then. So about 5 years ago, I'm working inside of this 18th century manor house, which is in the process of collapsing. It's stone. It's a brickwork in the front, but for some reason, they only put wood in the back. So the brick was starting to fall in onto itself. The home was pretty much on the verge of collapsing any moment now. They were going to try to restore it. So in order to restore it, they were going to have to put some footers into the floor, into the floor of the house, which meant archaeology needed to be done. So we raised up the floors. We crawled underneath these floors in a super confined space. I'm 6'2", way too big to be crawling underneath the floorboards. But there I was on my hands and knees going through this place where the top debris above the dirt was a mixture of sort of this really fine plastery dust, dander from whatever creatures was also had their dried poo within this entire area. So it's very claustrophobic working in these spots here. But sort of the horror aspects of it is that on the second floor, because the house is sort of twisted, it is about the front of the house was about 12 inches off leaning. And so if you stood upstairs on the second floor, at least for me, it caused vertigo because the floor looked flat, but my body knew this was not a flat surface. So that was one creepy aspect of it. The other part is that this is also a place where I ended up falling through the floor joist at one point and spraining my knee. And being a big dummy, I went ahead and finished working for the day. I'm like, it's fine, just hurts a little bit. And no, I had sprained my knee, my ankle, and a few other things. So whenever someone talks about haunted houses and stuff like that, I'm like, I've worked in them, and the biggest obstacles is the physical obstacles. And there's no ghost, no specters showed up, but darn it, was at hardworking conditions.
Yeah, I would say any of my conditions like that, really around historic mining sites in Nevada. That being said, I have seen plenty of old abandoned houses when I was working in the Southeast that, you know, you just kind of come upon during survey, and they're covered in vines and ivy, and maybe a tree fell through the roof or something like that. And you really want to go inside. Like, you really want to go inside, but it's just super dangerous. But I'll take my more recent experience of the historic mining sites. There's plenty of them that I can think of that have buildings on them. And often these mining sites are, they're usually in areas that are accessible. I mean, for one thing, there's roads that go to them. So they're accessible in the sense that you can actually drive to most of these things. And the only people that are driving to these are like the real kind of rural Nevadans that are either kids looking for a place to go drink and smoke and do whatever they're going to do, away from their parents, or they're hunters, or they're, you know, people just out for a joyride, and they find these things. So you find some interesting stuff inside of these. And I can think of a few where you go inside the structure and like the writing and the imagery on the walls, the graffiti and stuff like that, dating back 100 years in some cases, is just indescribable. It really is indescribable. It's just some of the things you see on there. And some of the words and I don't know, some of the writing styles. It's really interesting. I wouldn't say I've ever seen any ghosts or anything because I don't really buy into that so much. However, it's got a creepy vibe to it for sure. You go into these old things and you see all this crazy stuff. And then of course, there's always some weird doll, like baby doll that's usually naked, missing an eye, and you know, has no hair or something like that. Why are those on every site?
Yeah, the disembodied doll head is like a common theme in like creeped out archaeology, isn't it?
I mean, it is.
Like everybody has one of those stories. It's
not just a modern one. Like here in the East Coast, you'll get these sort of like 18th century versions, these small little porcelain figures called Frozen Charlottes. That you'll just find, or so there'll be these tiny little, maybe 3-inch porcelain figures, and by this point, of course, they're just completely stripped, just sort of this white figurine that you'll just randomly find on sites.
Nice. We found one on a project in Clear Lake, Virginia, one time, and we had our field vehicle, and I've talked about this on the show before, was like this 24-foot pontoon boat that we were driving around the lake on because we were doing this lake edge survey basically for a dam recertification. And somebody found one of these dolls and it was creepy as hell. And then he attached it to the front of the, to the front of the boat, like our, what is that called? When they just had the figure of the woman up there, like the masthead.
Oh, yeah.
Or whatever that's called. Yeah. We had that attached to the front of the boat. It was pretty intimidating. It's kind of a Mad Max feel to it.
I think following along, I have not had actual ghosts show up, but I remember a lot of the weirdest stuff that I ever encountered in the field happened in Washington because, back when I worked there, a lot of times they were building new subdivisions and stuff. So there were these lots that had been logged over a couple times and then they're overgrown with blackberries that then sometimes people had taken up, you know, residence. So they had different camps of, you know, homeless people or whatever in there, or, you know, meth labs and stuff in the blackberries. So you always had to be watching out. But one time I remember I was doing a survey and, when I would survey there, I had to, basically use my, shovel and screen to push the blackberries down or grab them with my gloves and then make them into a bundle and step up and over them so I could walk on top of the blackberry brambled, which was, you know, 6 or 7 feet tall. So you had to pull them down with your shovel and then make this kind of bridge across to get to the next shovel probe. So anyway, I remember I was doing that and I heard a rustling or something behind me and I turned around and I don't know, I think it was a squirrel or not a squirrel, like a raccoon or a deer or something that was running through the brush. So the guy that was behind me, I was like, "Hey man, did you see that?" And he's like, "Yeah, what was it?" And we couldn't figure out what it was. And then I looked up and all over this tree, over his head, was this red children's dress, like a dress that was on a zip line or something like that, that was like 30 something feet over this guy's head. And I was looking up like, why is this headless stuffed red children's girl's dress hanging from a steel wire up above this guy's head? I never figured out why, but there was just this swinging dress that was filled with, you know, cotton or whatever, so that it looked like it was an actual ghost flying in the air.
That's pretty creepy. Yeah. All right. Let's try to get one more in before we end the show. Steven.
Okay, here we go. 5, 5, 5, 5.
That brings us to the horror of Red Hook. Hmm. One of Lovecraft's more infamous short stories. So the horror of Pardon Red Hook takes place in the Red Hook neighborhood of Brooklyn, New York, in the early 20th century. It is most known, well, it's a story about gangs, cults, the occult underbelly of the city, crime, and so forth like that. But it's really most known, well, not most known nowadays for, but definitely nowadays known for its sort of xenophobia and racism. I do one little quote here that Lovecraft wrote in a letter to a fellow author, Clark Ashton Smith, to sort of set the stage for the story. "The idea that black magic exists in secret today, or that hellish antique rites still exist in obscurity and is one that I have used and shall use again. When you see my new vessel or story, the horrid Red Hook, you will see what use I make of it, of the idea in connection with the gangs and youth and gangs of young loafers and herds of evil looking foreigners that one sees everywhere in New York. This is a story written in sort of a brief time when he was married to a Sonia Green in 1924, leaving his beloved Providence, Rhode Island, making it to the big city, finding it terrifying, and then going back home to Providence, getting divorced, and staying there for the rest of his life. So with CRM, what I was thinking of is the ideas of racism, to be frank, both sort of within the field of CRM archaeology, and also within the subjects and pressures on there. I'm thinking specifically of things like if you've gone to an archaeological conference and you see the demographics in there, it seems to be in most places generally homogenous. There are certain pressures, especially if you're working for certain clients of foundations and so forth, where the ideology of certain groups will be pressured in terms of your finds. I'm thinking like it's historically here in the East Coast when it comes in terms of things like slavery, but it also is in place without, you know, in terms of Native American populations. Same is true on Japanese internment camps or just the archaeology of the Chinese diaspora on the West Coast. These are all very touchy topics where there are pressures sometimes on us. We step in sort of into a minefield on that. So any thoughts on that? Or we could always pivot to urban archaeology since this place takes place in New York.
Yeah, I've got some. Nothing like no really good anecdotes, but it does make me think about how a lot of times the agencies and the funding audience, so let's call them that, but basically the clients and the agencies and stuff like that, they don't want, what they want is a happy history. They don't want like the idea that, you know, things weren't always great or, you know, that maybe, you know, our ancestral groups or these people's ancestral groups didn't always do nice things. And it's not a really easy thing to deal with when you have clients who are like, you know, agencies who are like, oh, no, you know, segregation, you know, was never really a thing or, you know, it was a thing, ha, 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 and they try to laugh it off. You know, dealing with that is kind of the, you know, so I guess I'm pivoting a little bit because I'm talking less about, you know, the cities and stuff like that. I'm thinking in terms of more of Lovecraft's story and how he perceived stuff and how we as, you know, readers of Lovecraft are now like, well, awfully racist. You know, and you know, some people still kind of try to laugh that part off, but you know, those things still are things. And I don't think we serve anybody by not addressing it when it's part of you know the culturals that we're dealing with.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right when you mentioned that there's an effort to create a certain kind of narrative. So you know, a lot of people want. Well, I guess I won't name individual races, but I think we all know who is doing most of the archaeology and who's actually kind of in charge of our contracts and stuff like that. And there's groups out there, Native Americans and other folks who don't consider themselves white, who want their stories told because for hundreds of years, there has been a proliferation of those kind of happy histories where, you know, there's people who are discovering things and exploring and whoops, accidentally, a lot of people from, you know, an entire tribe get killed. But in the process, we had the founding of so-and-so town, right? So there's kind of a, you know, lionization of the whole colonial adventure, I guess, in North America. But there's also a total reluctance to embrace any of those uncomfortable situations. And part of the whole thing of, you know, why can't we just go and find people from that tribe who will work with us? I mean, the number one reason why is because for hundreds of years, those individuals haven't really had any positive interactions with white people. So when they're in a situation where it's 99% white people, they feel totally uncomfortable. Not only that, but when it comes to racism, everybody will look to them to be the one who fixes race, right? When it's the other 90% of the people who are the ones who actually need to embrace it and actually think about what's going on and be a bit more introspective, right? And so we would think that archaeologists and anthropologists would kind of be at the front of this because we're the ones who are doing work in Native communities and with Black communities and stuff. But the reality is, because of that discomfort and because so many people are socialized to not embrace that or to not even think or engage with that kind of thought, there's a lot of laughing off that happens. So in a room where there's minorities, there's not going to be laughing off. There's going to be kind of a, yes, this is serious, we need to focus on it. But in a room of white people, there will be a laughing off and kind of a, like, you know, deflect the conversation to something else, because it does make people uncomfortable. I mean, it does make people uncomfortable, but as long as we don't even approach it or try, then there's not going to be any forward motion.
So, Bill, I got a question for you, Bill White. You know, the answer to all this, as you really just alluded to, is a lot more diversity in the field, right? The more different people we have in the room, the less likely that stuff's going to be laughed off and more opinions will be heard and more perspectives will be given. So to use as an example, Bill, you're a part of the Society of, is it a Society of or Society for Black Archaeologists?
Society of Black Archaeologists, yeah.
Okay. So everybody knows that creating a society of white archaeologists would be a really bad idea,
yeah,
right?
Like,
so
I thought it
so
was called the SAA. No, I'm just joking.
You're totally right.
I'm a member of the SAA.
Wait, that doesn't stand for Society of Anglo-Archaeologists?
I don't know. I'm a member of it. I didn't know that.
Anyway, so since we know that starting a society of white archaeologists would be a bad idea, but starting a society of Black archaeologists is a good idea, what state does our business, our field, need to get into when Society of Black Archaeologists is a bad idea? You know what I mean? What's the goal?
In reality, some archaeologists... I know you and I know some of these archaeologists who think a Society of Black Archaeologists is a bad idea.
It's not
a necessary thing, and that we don't need that, and that it just detracts, right? So So what we need is for when racist stuff happens, when it's only all white people or all the white archaeologists are together and they say that, someone doesn't laugh it off and they push it into that discomfort. Mm-hmm. Now, the problem that'll happen is that individual will become known as someone who's not part of the team. They're not a team player. They're not like us. And you know what? I need to keep my mouth shut around her because she's going to say something and make me feel uncomfortable, right? But if there's nowhere to go, then everybody is forced to face that, right? If this person is also calling you out on it, and then you go to the good old boys at the shooting range and they're calling you out on it, and then all of a sudden it's kind of just not okay anymore. And there's no safe space for this to happen, right? So the society... a Black archaeologist can do whatever we're doing, but, you know, I don't want it to be a situation where we're the ones who are doing the Black archaeology thing and then everybody else is left to just do archaeology, which in parentheses before the archaeology is just white archaeology, right? So I don't want it to be like that. I want it to be that people are addressing this on all levels and not giving it space to survive. So when those clients are saying those racist things and trying to laugh it off, nobody laughs. That's not funny. Mm-hmm. When that's not funny, and it's not funny at the mine, and it's not funny at the construction site, it's not funny here, it's not funny there, then all of a sudden it's just kind of not a thing that can happen in professional parlance. That's what I would like to see happen.
Yeah, and that's a tall order. I don't think it's a tall as order as we think amongst archaeologists, but when you're dealing with clients, like you said, I mean, a lot of times we're dealing with clients in pretty rural areas and clients that are, you know, right-leaning and have these sort of ideas, and they do make those jokes all the time. And I think people's natural inclination from a customer service perspective is to laugh along with them and not want to make any waves. You know what I mean? But we can't, we have to stop doing that.
Yeah. You just, like, the first step is to just stop laughing and to look them in the eye.
Yeah.
If you stop laughing and you look them in the eye, then either they're going to double down and be an even bigger asshole and try to dig themselves deeper and show that they're even more racist, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, the first step is to say nothing. The second step is when you see that kind of stuff happening at the SAA, at our local conferences, at our meetings, not only do you stop laughing, you just say something about it. Because those are our professional community, right? We can influence our friends and family in the professional community. I don't know about influencing some construction company I've only worked with for 6 weeks, you know, one time 6 years ago. I'm probably not going to influence those people.
Right.
But I mean, the first step is to influence your own self, to have the courage to not laugh, and then to just build on that and to have the courage to say something.
Indeed. Okay. Well, that is a great place to end this episode on. I love doing these. So if anybody has any suggestions for, you know, how we could do some more of these going forward, or maybe you want to participate, we'll bring you on as a guest host. So send me an email, chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com, or find us on the socials. And then finally, if you're listening to this in real time, it is the end of October 2018. I will be at the Great Basin Anthropological Conference in Salt Lake City in early November. And the 2 days after that, I'll be in Augusta, Georgia for the Southeastern Archaeology Conference as well. I'll be in the Wild Note booth in the exhibit hall on both occasions. So come and say hi. I might even have some APN stickers that I'll give you. And I might bring some other stickers as well if I think about it. So come on and say hi. It's not an APN booth, so don't look for that. I'll be in the Wild Note booth. So do that, and we will see you guys next time. Hey, the next episode, we've got a great interview that's really out of the box for CRM Archaeology. It's really more about leadership and other stuff from an industry leader that just wrote a book about all this kind of stuff. So it's not going to be about archaeology per se, but really great for people in leadership positions. All right, we'll see you guys next time.
That's it for another episode of the CRM Archaeology Podcast. Links to some of the items mentioned on the show are in the show notes for this podcast, which can be found at www.archpodnet.com/CRMArchPodcast. Please comment and share anywhere you see the show. If you'd like us to answer a question on a future episode, email us. Use the contact form on the website, or just email chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Support the show and the network at archpodnet.com/members. Get some swag and extra content while you're there. Send us show suggestions and interview suggestions. We want this to be a resource for field technicians everywhere, and we want to know what you want to know about.
All right, thanks to everyone for joining me this week. Thanks also to the listeners for tuning in, and we'll see you in the field. Goodbye.
Adios.
Bye.
Bye.
So boring without Doug.
I was just going to say, you guys just tried to get me to stop being silent and wait for Doug. So I just started laughing right away, but there is no Doug.
There is no Doug. That's what you got to remember. It's like the Matrix. Not there is no spoon. There is no Doug. All right.
I met him once. He's real.
This show is produced and recorded by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle, in Reno, Nevada, at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.